Portland Police Bureau said at a news conference that the officers involved did not have tasers. Outlaw said, quote, "Every police officer is not issued a taser at this time. It's common for officers to respond to a domestic disturbance or any type of call with a gun because that's one of the tools that we carry on our tool belt." Both officers, whose names have not been released, were taken off street duty pending an investigation. Monday evening, protesters gathered and marched through the city. Outlaw said 91 people were arrested and 30 officers were injured. White House Communications Director Alyssa Farah said the White House is prepared to deploy federal resources in response to the unrest. On Tuesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 391 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total number of confirmed and presumptive cases up to 42,808. Oregon health officials also reported 9 new deaths, bringing the state's death toll up to 664 people. COVID-19 continues to have an accelerated impact on Oregon's prison population. Inmates in Oregon's prison system have been infected with COVID-19 at nearly 10 times the rate of Oregonians as a whole. So far, more than 1,200 inmates have tested positive and 16 have died, 13 of whom passed away in the last 2 months alone. Portland lawyer Tara Harrivel is leading a team of more than 20 defense attorneys who have filed legal complaints on behalf of over 230 inmates against the Oregon Department of Corrections or local jails for what they describe as a deliberate indifference to the health and safety of inmates. The court filings ask judges across the state to order prison and jail systems to implement a host of COVID-19 safety measures or release inmates back into society where they can better protect themselves. In Washington state, education officials announced on Monday that small groups of 10 or fewer kindergartners will transition to in-person classes in Clark County. According to Dr. Alan Melnick, the Clark County Health Officer and Public Health Director, the decision was made in collaboration with Clark County Public Health and aligns with Washington state guidance for opening schools. The guidance allows for in-person education for small groups of the highest need students, including younger learners. The school districts that will bring in small groups of kindergarten students are Battleground, Camas, Evergreen, Green Mountain, Hawkinson, La Center, Ridgefield, Vancouver, and Washougal. Officials said each school district will make its own plan for how and when kindergarten classes will begin. Districts will provide more information to employees and families in the coming weeks. Nationally, more than 8.8 million people in the U.S. have been infected with COVID-19. At least 226,000 people with the virus have died across the country. Over the past week, there have been an average of about 71,000 cases per day, an increase of 40% from the average 2 weeks earlier. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 43.7 million people in nearly every country. At least 1.1 million people have died across the world. Oregon residents who have been impacted by the deadly wildfires in September are able to apply for federal disaster aid. The deadline to apply for assistance is November 16th. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
The federal government is offering disaster relief to Oregonians affected by the September wildfires. With the deadline approaching, information on how to apply is especially important for older folks and people with mobility issues. Danielle Bailey is a disability integration specialist for the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Region 10, which covers the Northwest. She says efforts to reach people this year are not like other years.
Usually we have disaster survivor assistance teams that are able to go door to door. So due to COVID-19, that's not feasible in this type of situation.
Bailey says FEMA has been relying on partner agencies and organizations and communities to get the word out on assistance. The deadline to apply is November 16th. A variety of aid is available in most Western Oregon counties. State Director of AARP Oregon, Ruby Houghton-Pitts, says disaster to people's homes and COVID-19 aren't the only factors that could hinder people from applying for assistance.
Not everybody, especially older adults, has access to all of the online internet capabilities that the rest of us may have at our fingertips.
Houghton-Pitts encourages friends and family to tell their loved ones about assistance and to apply as soon as possible if they need it. Folks can apply over the phone or online. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Monday that Wisconsin can disregard mail-in ballots that arrive after Election Day. Voting rights groups, the state and national Democratic parties, and the League of Women Voters had sued to extend the deadline to accept mail-in ballots. U.S. District Judge William Conley agreed and ordered the state to accept ballots that arrive up to 6 days after Election Day, provided they are postmarked before the polls close. The Supreme Court ruled that Wisconsin cannot count mail-in ballots that arrive after Election Day. The ruling was 5-3, coming just before the Senate voted to add Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. Liberal Justices Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, and Stephen Breyer dissented from the court's decision. Early voting began in Wisconsin last week, and the state has seen a major influx of absentee ballots being returned, the same as many other states. According to data from the State Elections Commission, as of October 19th, voters in Wisconsin had returned more than 863,000 absentee ballots. Last week, the court upheld a ruling by a state court in Pennsylvania that extended the mail-in ballot deadline for the state. Unlike in Pennsylvania, the Wisconsin order concerned a ruling from a lower federal court, not a state court, and Chief Justice John Roberts said that made a difference. Roberts wrote in a concurring opinion that the federal district court, quote, intervened in the thick of election season. He added that the case represented, quote, federal intrusion on state lawmaking processes. AT&T has announced they are discontinuing their DSL service, throwing rural residents into uncertainty. Nadia Ramlagan has more on the story with the Public News Service.
AT&T has announced it's retiring its digital subscriber line, Broadband Internet, putting more than 469,000 DSL customers into uncertainty over the future of their internet access and leaving new residents of DSL-only areas with few options. Critics say as more companies phase out phone line services, rural residents could be left stranded with no access to reliable internet. AT&T is the first telecommunications giant to announce its retiring DSL. Harold Felt of the communications advocacy group Public Knowledge says unlike copper telephone lines, which reach virtually every part of the country, internet, cable, and fiber optic networks are primarily accessible in urban areas. He says shelving DSL without implementing a reliable substitute will disrupt rural economies.
Often in these small rural areas, the copper DSL line is also the one connection for the local business, which means you're not going to be able to process credit cards anymore. You're not going to be able to do automatic teller deposit.
Feld says the pandemic has put the spotlight on problems with internet access in rural communities. As kids continue to learn remotely and families rely on the internet for grocery shopping and telehealth, AT&T says that while new customers are no longer able to place a new order for DSL, current DSL users will be able to continue their existing service. Feld says the Trump administration's 2018 Restoring Internet Freedom Order eased previous regulations that would have allowed the government to prevent companies from dropping services that left parts of the country without internet options.
Broadband under the Obama administration had been classed as a Title II communications utility, meaning that you can't turn it off without permission from the FCC. When the Trump FCC reclassified it as a information service as opposed to a communication service, the FCC eliminated its own authority.
The FCC maintains that the high cost of broadband regulations discourages companies from investing in these rural areas. Feld says for most of the country's history, telecommunications services were viewed as critically essential for everyone.
Imagine if we said, well, you know what? We don't have to provide electricity to everybody in the country. We'll only provide it to the 85% of people where you get a good financial return, and those other 15% are just out of luck.
For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth look at the Gresham mayoral race. Then at 6, it's preference. And at 7, calculated conversation. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 39 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy with a high of 63 degrees. Today in history, in 1904, the New York City subway opens to the general public. More than 100,000 people paid one nickel each to take their first ride. Today, some 4.5 million passengers ride the subway in New York each day. The quote of the day is from American cultural anthropologist Margaret Mead, who said, quote, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." The Senate confirmed Judge Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the Supreme Court in a nearly party-line vote. GOP Senator Susan Collins, up for re-election, was the lone Republican vote against. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
There were a number of people who attended that Rose Garden event who became sick, who were quite embarrassed by their participation, who had to go back to their constituencies and communities and explain their behavior.
Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser urged caution for folks attending last night's swearing-in ceremony at the White House for newly confirmed Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett after five of Vice President Mike Pence's close aides tested positive for COVID-19. Barrett took the first constitutional oath swiftly after the Senate's late evening vote. The judicial oath is today. It's the fastest confirmation in over 40 years and first ever this close to an election. 62 million Americans have already voted early. Maryland began yesterday. On a 52-48 nearly party-line vote, Maine Senator Susan Collins was the lone Republican to oppose the confirmation. Reporter Jacob Rubashkin with Inside Elections says many Maine voters still hold her vote for Brett Kavanaugh against her.
Even though she's taking that kind of independent tack that she has built up her brand around, I still think the mere existence of a Supreme Court vacancy is a net negative for her because it reminds voters about the last one.
President Donald Trump and allies have worked to cast doubt on this year's elections with false claims about vote by mail and other attempts to protect access during the pandemic. Jeff Timmer, a former Republican strategist in Michigan, now with the Lincoln Project, thinks the rushed confirmation is an anticipation of legal challenges that could affect state as well as national elections.
Some of these states where Trump and Biden are very competitive are also the states where the senators might lose. And being able to throw the election results into litigation might be a last-ditch attempt by McConnell to hold on to the majority by hook or by crook.
Timmer agrees with those who think jamming the confirmation through now is hypocritical after Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocked the vote on former President Obama's nominee because it was an election year in 2016.
The incongruity of the arguments that were made 4 years ago and now are so striking.
GOP Senator Lindsey Graham pushed the vote through the Judiciary Committee. He faces a tight re-election against Democrat Jamie Harrison, who recalled Graham's 2016 words at a recent rally in South Carolina.
Our senator said, use my words against me. Hold the tape. Use my words against me. We should not be considering a Supreme Court justice. That's what Lindsey Graham said.
South Carolina has been a staunchly Republican state, but yesterday their oldest newspaper, The State, endorsed Harrison. And for the first time in 100 years, New Hampshire's largest newspaper, The Union Leader, endorsed a Democrat for president, former Vice President Joe Biden. According to UC Santa Barbara's Presidency Project, Biden has the backing of 44 of the U.S.'s 100 largest newspapers. Five have endorsed Trump. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening.
Alaska's highest court decides the home of Tlingit artifacts, and Senator Udall of New Mexico raises concerns about Native health care. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A collection of artifacts from the Tlingit Frog House Clan can continue to be displayed in a Klukwan museum. That's despite a legal challenge that reached Alaska's highest court. As Claire Strimple with KHNS reports, the state Supreme Court has apparently ended a decades-old dispute over control of the cultural treasures.
When Froghouse Klan members disputed the sale of artifacts to a Canadian collector in the 1970s, an Alaska Superior Court judge ruled that they actually belonged to all members of Klukwan's Froghouse. The court ordered them placed in the care of Klan elders living in the Klan's traditional lands on the Upper Lynn Canal. It added a condition. They could only be sold with the unanimous consent of all Froghouse Klan members. Until a safe place was found near Klukwan, the artifacts would sit in the State Museum in Juneau. There they remained for decades. Until last year, when the carvings, considered masterpieces, were returned to Klukwan. But that didn't sit well with some descendants, who filed a lawsuit last summer. They argued that by housing the artifacts in the tribe's heritage center, the court had given them to the whole tribe rather than the Froghouse. Petersburg attorney Fred Treem made a case in September that the Jilkatkwan Heritage Center in Klukwan kept the artifacts out of the Klan's reach.
The Froghouse Klan members, of whom there are 104, cannot use the artifacts. The artifacts are locked up in a museum that's not under the control or even reasonably accessible to the Froghouse members.
But the state's Supreme Court justices were unmoved. In a decision released on October 21st, they wrote the lower court had been correct, and only exceptional circumstances could overturn the ruling from 1978. The four house posts and a copy of a carved screen are displayed at the Jilkatkwan Heritage Center in Klukwan. The center is closed for the season, but group tours are available by appointment. I'm Claire Strempel.
New Mexico U.S. Senator Tom Udall spoke on the Senate floor Monday, calling for the protection of health care for Native Americans before the Senate confirmation of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the U.S. Supreme Court. Udall raised concerns about the future of the Affordable Care Act due to upcoming challenges. Udall says a repeal would devastate Indian country.
The ACA has opened the doors for so many Native Americans to access the care they need. Whether it's an unplanned medical emergency or routine wellness checkups and screenings. Access to quality health care is critical for Native communities which face disproportionate impacts from the COVID-19 pandemic. The federal government has a trust and treaty obligation to consult with tribes and to provide Native Americans health care.
The Affordable Care Act permanently reauthorized the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, key legal authority for the Indian Health Service, and expansion of access to health care for Native Americans. Udall was among a group of senators in opposition of Barrett's Supreme Court nomination. Racial equity groups are hosting a virtual event Tuesday night to mobilize voters in Arizona, a key battleground state. The National Congress of American Indians is joining Hispanic, Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and other groups to host the event to discuss voting and a number of issues from COVID-19 to racial justice. The event will be streamed on Facebook at Together We Vote, AZ. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Smoke from historic wildfires has forced evacuations of medical facilities and caused an uptick in heart attacks and respiratory illness. Thousands of doctors have now penned a letter urging action on climate change. Suzanne Potter has more on the story with the Public News Service.
More than 4,300 doctors and nurses have just published an open letter to patients urging them to demand action on climate change. The letter, which is backed by 16 national and state-level medical organizations, declares that climate change is a health issue. Dr. Amanda Milstein is a pediatrician from Richmond and founder of a group called Climate Health Now. She says extreme weather events worsened by climate change are impacting access to health care.
Twice in August, we actually made the decision to close our clinic because even with the use of an air filter, our indoor air quality because of wildfire smoke was so poor that it was unhealthy to bring babies and children into our clinic.
Milstein says wildfires and flooding can overwhelm hospitals with an influx of patients or force them to evacuate altogether. Higher temperatures exacerbate pollution and drive a spike in heart attacks, respiratory illness, and heat stroke. Stagnant water increases the risk of waterborne infectious diseases. Milstein also warns that children especially are vulnerable to asthma and allergies because they breathe faster than adults and spend more time outside.
With warmer temperatures, we're seeing an increase in the amount of pollen and other allergens that are in the air. So we're seeing a significant spike in children who are suffering from seasonal allergies.
The letter calls for policies that move toward a clean energy economy and prioritize the needs of the community over profits for the fossil fuel industry. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Researchers say the U.S. cannot meet Paris Climate Accord goals without federal leadership. If the federal government, states, cities, and businesses work together, cuts to carbon pollution are still possible. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. After President Trump announced that the U.S. will exit the Paris Climate Agreement, many U.S. states, cities, and businesses stepped up with their own commitments to cut carbon pollution. Carla Frisch is with the Rocky Mountain Institute, a nonprofit think tank. She's part of a team that's been crunching numbers to figure out
what's really happening on the ground in the United States on climate and figure out what's the impact of those actions. So what does it really add up to?
The researchers estimate that in 10 years, if the states, cities, and businesses fully implement their plans, U.S. greenhouse gas emissions will be 25% less than they were in 2005. That's significant, but to stay in line with the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement, the U.S. needs to cut emissions by almost twice that. The researchers found that making those larger cuts in carbon pollution is still feasible, but Frisch says it will require a nationwide commitment to transitioning to renewable energy and electric vehicles, among other strategies.
We have to have federal leadership, and we have to have leadership from states and cities and businesses. So this is not an either-or situation. But together, we can put the U.S. on track to drastic emissions reductions.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kopanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Romlagon, Suzanne Potter, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kopanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, featuring a conversation with Jared Yates Sexton about his new book, American Rule: How a Nation Conquered the World But Failed Its People. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 9:30, Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw covers art, culture, and politics with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Art Talk Bus Stop, featuring interviews with artists, curators, and performers. And at 11:30, it's Radio Zine. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We're currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give. Or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The November race for Gresham Mayor is a crowded one, with 5 candidates on the ballot. Many of the candidates have concerns about how Gresham residents are able to get involved with their local government as well as the city's financial health. First, we'll hear from candidate Eddie Morales, who spoke with KBOO's Brian Oster.
Eddie Morales has served as treasurer of Oregon's Democratic Party for over 3 years
and was elected to Gresham City Council in 2018. It was the city's largest voter turnout. He lived in Washington, D.C. for over a decade and founded the grassroots community organization East County Rising to mobilize voters and give people in East Multnomah County more of a voice in policy. Now he's running for mayor of Gresham. Eddie Morales, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show, Brian.
Some of your priorities are parks, affordable housing, and public funding for Gresham Senior Center. What's the common thread here?
Yeah, so for the last two decades, our city has been run by a small group of people who really used the city hall and government to enrich themselves and really just took care of a small group of business community members. And the larger part of our city has been neglected. And so these are issues that have been of importance to our community. You know, our community is almost 40% Black, Indigenous, people of color, almost 20% non-U.S. born. And about one in five people in Gresham are living under federal poverty level. And so these issues never really got the attention or the resources that they needed. And so when I ran 2 years ago, my campaign was really about engaging all parts of Gresham in City Hall, and then really advancing equity, inclusion, and transparency.
One of your opponents, Joe Demers, expressed concern that affordable housing drives investors away from the city. What do you think?
That's actually, not true. We have a housing shortage here in East County and in Gresham. We are one of the fastest growing cities in the state. We're the fourth largest and really the largest suburb to Portland. And our housing supply has not kept up with our growth. Additionally, people on the east side of Multnomah County are still making about 50 cents to the dollar for the same types of jobs. And so not only do we need more affordable housing for the population that has and is moving here, we just have a shortage in supply. And so I think housing our people, providing housing security, is one of the basic fundamentals in creating a strong economy that can attract and keep businesses around.
You want to change the way city councilors are elected. Why is that?
Yeah, so, our city used to have districts back in the day. And again, when this small group of people, mostly business people from the Chamber of Commerce, took control of the city hall over 20 years ago, they changed that from, changed our rules from having districts to being at large, mostly to try to ensure that they maintain control of city hall. Now, for so long, we really haven't had contested elections in Gresham. It's been that small group of people hand-picking individuals to put on the Gresham City Council. Majority of them have represented two neighborhoods predominantly. And although Rockwood, which is our largest, our most populous and most diverse neighborhood, they've never had somebody elected from Rockwood to represent them on City Hall. And so there is disparity and probably a violation of laws by not having more voting districts. There's a difference between my opponents and I. When Proud Boys threatened to come rip down, so I voted and supported having the Black Lives Matter flag flown over City Hall. I think we're one of the only cities in the state, maybe even in the country, where a city government did that. Proud Boys threatened to come rip it down, and they called for people to bring guns. And I went out and stood on the front line saying that this was going to be destruction of our property and that we were not going to take hate crimes, hate violence, or destruction of property here, and that people would be arrested for that. My opponent either stood on the side of the Proud Boys when that happened, promoting that kind of behavior, and or are acting like they didn't know that the Black Lives Matter flew over City Hall and hasn't been to any of it or have any relationship with our Black community members. early November really look at the way that we show up and lead for our community.
That's Eddie Morales, who's running for mayor of Gresham. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Brian Oster.
Next, we'll hear from candidate Joe Demers, who spoke with KBOO's Claire Rosciato.
Joe, why should Gresham voters vote for you?
Because we're in dire straits financially right now. We need to make sure that we're not spending our money in places that shouldn't be spent. We're $13.3 million in the hole on our general budget because of neglect to our PFP fund since its inception in 2012. And we have a $50 million line of credit that I think is going to indebt our city, and we need smart choices right now in spending. And move towards prioritizing our spending, and I believe I have the best skill set for prioritizing.
How do your personal and professional experiences prepare you to be Gresham's mayor?
I'm a commercial driver of over 20 years experience, and what that does is, I've learned a lot of logistical and organizational skills delivering products all over the Northwest. It also taught me how to be a professional router, so I can look at any roadmap and make the assessment, especially if there's construction or something like that, to be able to take an additional route with the least amount of obstacles. How that correlates with the city in the mayor position, I have the skills in order to guide us through situations coming down the line and be able to assess those and make the best moves in a similar way to have the least amount of obstacles. So, like one of the things, for example, we have a moratorium in place that the governor has put in place for non-evictions on rental properties. And I believe I have the ideas to take us through that to make critical in its outcome for the future when that comes down the line for evictions, to make sure families aren't going to end up greed and increase our home problem here on the east side.
Got it. Joe, you've been criticized by various media outlets and individuals for organizing a protest against Gresham City Council having a Black Lives Matter sign outside their building. For constituents, what would be your constituents of color if you were to become mayor? How do you address their concerns over that protest? And do you believe in the Black Lives Matter movement in terms of specifically ridding of discrimination and mistreatment of Black and brown people?
I don't support the movement. A lot of the lay people that are involved in the movement, I don't think fully understand what the organization itself is for. Their website specifically said that they aim to disrupt the Western nuclear family, and that is not something that I agree with. They've since been taken that down. But it's not to say that our government can't help minority communities. I disagreed with flying the flag because I believe, and a lot of people here in Gresham believe, that that's a partisan stance. I believe the same would have been felt if we would have flown a Trump 2020 flag up on the flagpole, and that would have got a huge negative response. So as a nonpartisan government, I believe we shouldn't have approached that at all. We could have, approached helping the community, the Black community, in different ways than flying a flag and making that stance in government to make other people mad.
So what do you say to your fellow Gresham voters, whether they're white or a person of color, who want to see change for folks who are being discriminated by police specifically in terms of there being racial injustice and even violence from the police?
Well, we haven't, there isn't any evidence here in Gresham that there are large amounts of discrimination happening from our police in Gresham. They have an excellent reputation. And I believe, you know, if our the minority communities want to make change, they should approach the matter just like everybody else, where it's a merit-based system.
That was Gresham mayoral candidate Joe Demers speaking with Claire Rosciato. Finally, we'll hear from candidate Travis Stovall, who spoke with KBOO's Nat Moon.
We are sitting down with Travis Stovall, who is running for Gresham mayor. So Travis, why don't you tell us a little about yourself and why you decided to run for mayor?
Excellent, of course. So I'm born and raised Kansan. I moved to Oregon roughly about 20 years ago. And when I first moved here, I was a windsurfer and a snow skier. And so the east side was ideal, being that we're just less than an hour from the mountain, less than an hour from Hood River to do some amazing world-class windsurfing. And so I landed on the east side of Portland. I used to work for Adventist Health. I used to be a healthcare executive back in the day. And so since the majority of our efforts are here on the east side, I again landed in Gresham roughly about 14 years ago. I lived just off of Jenny Road and Powell before moving to Gresham proper about 14 years ago. And since then, I've launched two companies here in the Gresham area. Also led the East Metro Economic Alliance for 8 years as its executive director, and I've been on the TriMet board for 9 years. So a lot of service to the east side and Gresham, the four cities, which include Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. So I've been pretty active over the last 14, 15 years since moving to the area. And because of, you know, a lot of that experience I've had, leading TriMet, I sit on the TriMet board, I am the vice chair of the board, and I chair the Finance and Audit Committee. So I've got that fiscal kind of focus and abilities and opportunity. I have a finance business administration with an emphasis in finance for my undergrad and then a master's in business administration from the University of Nebraska. So all of that is in place in regards to having a lot of experience in that space and in the space of leadership and public leadership and those types of things. And it's really so that's really got me excited about the opportunity to lean into some of the challenges that we're going to have, you know, with the COVID situation coming up and reducing our budgets, but also being an African-American man, it is an amazing time for us to be able to lean into the social justice conversation. And that's really the second piece that really has caused me to want to join this race and be mayor of Gresham, is to bring the kind of the fiscal focus, the things that we need to do there, making sure that we're moving the city forward, but also at the same time, how do we do this with an equity lens and an equity focus to make sure that we can have formative conversations that leads to long-term systemic change?
What is the biggest issue facing Gresham, and how would you fix it?
The biggest issue facing Gresham is our budget. Currently we've got some structural challenges in our permanent tax rates that we have to have key conversations around. And so we've got to apply the participatory budgeting concept, because up until this point, I think we've done a decent job of kind of filling in the holes. But long term, we've got to include our incredible citizenry and the ability to have them lean into this conversation. First and foremost, we've got to make the whole budget stuff way simpler, because the dollars and cents are there in the broader community. But for the most part, I don't think we've done the best job in explaining it in plain sense so that folks can understand where their dollars are going. I think folks are interested in making investments in our communities, similar to the bond that just passed in regards to the Gresham Barlow School District. Got a significant bond to do a bunch of upgrades. Well, that's an additional tax. I'm not saying that additional taxes are the only way to solve all of our problems, but we've got to have hard discussions and decisions around how are we going to fund these investments. And that starts with ensuring that our budgets are something that people can be involved in by way of making it plain sense type of language. And so that's got to be it. You know, we've got to encourage and incorporate our citizens into this conversation in ways that they can understand. Because many times we put the budget stuff out there, and a lot of times even accountants, and I'm an accountant by training, sometimes a lot of folks just don't understand what's being presented. Because we've got to look at the opportunity of potentially bringing on some type of special districts, either for police and fire or parks, so that we can open up some of that permanent tax rate potentially for the additional resources that we need as a community.
Travis, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Not a problem, Nat. Thank you for the time.
That was KBOO's Nat Moon speaking with Travis Stovall. This has been three of the candidates for Gresham Mayor discussing their candidacies. Sean Bishop and Nick Switzer did not return requests for comment. Thanks to Brian Oster, Claire Rosciato, and Nat Moon for their help with this reporting. Find this story and our other election coverage online at kboo.fm/elections. A reminder that Oregon ballots must be placed in official ballot drop boxes by 8 p.m. on November 3rd. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. Psilocybin-assisted therapy will be on the ballot this November, and KBOO is here to provide an overview of what the measure entails in order to help our listeners be informed voters on November 3rd. We spoke with Tom Eckert, a psychotherapist in Portland and one of the chief petitioners of the measure, as well as Mark Fettman, a psychiatrist in Portland who would like to see psilocybin-assisted therapy sometime in the future, but is unhappy with the conditions of the measure. Oregon Measure 109, the Psilocybin Program Initiative, will be on the ballot on November 3rd. A yes vote supports authorizing the Oregon Health Authority to create a program permitting licensed service providers to administer psilocybin to individuals 21 and older. A no vote opposes the creation of this program. If passed, the Oregon Health Authority would have 2 years to develop the program. People would only be allowed to purchase and consume psilocybin at the service center and under the direct supervision of the service provider after undergoing a preparation session. Over this 2-year period, OHA would determine what qualifications, education, and training are needed for the service providers and create a code of professional conduct for the facilitators. OHA would also be responsible for setting dosage standards and labeling and packaging the drug. Psilocybin, like marijuana, is still classified federally as a Schedule I drug by the Drug Enforcement Agency. In 2019, the Federal Drug Administration designated psilocybin therapy as a breakthrough therapy, a designation meant to, quote, expedite the development and review of drugs intended to treat a serious condition. And as the mental health crisis in the state is among the worst in the nation, many are hopeful that new therapies can help people suffering from depression, anxiety, and addiction. If this measure passes, Oregon would be the first state to legalize the use of psilocybin products. And, if passed, Measure 109 would still prohibit the possession, manufacturing, and consumption of psilocybin outside of designated service centers. The measure has garnered over 160,000 signatures from Oregon residents and has received support from U.S. Representative Earl Blumenauer, the Democratic Party of Oregon, Dr. Bronner Soaps, the ACLU of Oregon, and Moms United to End the War on Drugs. The Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association opposes Measure 109. The Oregon Psilocybin Society, founded in 2016 by Portland psychotherapists Tom and Cherie Eckert, has been leading the Yes on 109 campaign. Here's Tom Eckert speaking to how he believes Measure 109 could help Oregonians.
Measure 109 is the psilocybin therapy initiative in Oregon. So what we're doing is we're advancing a framework that will allow access to psilocybin-assisted therapy. So psilocybin-assisted therapy, of course, has a growing body of research supporting its safety and efficacy, and it's going to help Oregonians address what's really become a mental health crisis across the state. We have some of the worst rates of mental health and mental illness in the country. So we're really looking for new therapeutic options that are effective, and this modality addresses all kind of a spectrum of mental health issues, ranging from depression and anxiety and even addictions. the lingering effects of trauma, things like that. So we see this as a really exciting approach to address some of our big issues here in Oregon.
The measure is for assisted psilocybin therapy. Here, Tom talks us through the experience.
You make a good point. We're advancing psilocybin therapy. So when we talk about therapy, we're actually talking about a sequence of sessions, a sequence of therapeutic sessions. Begins with a preparation session. So a client would come into a licensed facility and see a licensed facilitator and kind of get oriented to what's to come in terms of the next session, which would be the psilocybin session. There'd also be, in that first session, a kind of an assessment for potential contraindications, make sure that it's a really good fit moving forward. And then maybe a day or two later, you go into a psilocybin session itself, and that's where you have the experience. Of course, psilocybin is a natural compound found in lots of species of mushrooms, and so you ingest the psilocybin, and it takes you into an experience. And that's really hard to describe, as many who have dabbled in it would tell you. So I'm not even going to venture to try to describe the experience other than to say that it promotes a real flexibility of mind. And a lot of people who are struggling, whether it's with a diagnosed mental health issue or just in general in life, you know, our tendency is to get caught up in loops and patterns, and certainly depression and anxiety and addictions kind of fit into that spectrum of issues where we basically get stuck. And psilocybin has this way of creating a profound experience that promotes a flexibility of mind so that you can see yourself and see your world in a different way. And that brings up potentially insights and epiphanies and breakthroughs. And then after the experience winds down and you safely come to nobody's leaving the facility, nobody's driving home all altered or anything like that. But once the psilocybin experience comes to an end, then a couple days later, you have an integration session or a sequence of integration sessions. And that's where you do the kind of more active talk therapy to kind of talk about those insights and epiphanies and make them part of your practice moving forward in a kind of healing journey. And so that's why it's psilocybin therapy. So the psilocybin experience itself is very internal. It's not a talk therapy session. It's really working within your own energies, often with music playing or in a quiet room with just gentle affirmation from a facilitator. They really don't, kind of enter into the experience unless necessary. And that's kind of the way it works. And again, this is the modality that's been advancing at great institutions like Johns Hopkins and NYU and UCLA for a variety of addressing a variety of issues, including depression. And the outcomes have been really off the charts. So, psychology, therapy, psychiatry, we really need a breakthrough therapy. And in fact, the FDA has identified psilocybin-assisted therapy as a breakthrough therapy, meaning that it's showing promise beyond what already exists. And that's what we need in Oregon.
The Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association has publicly said it opposes Measure 109, largely because psilocybin has not yet passed through Phase 3 of FDA approval. Phase 3 of the FDA approval process involves several thousand patients that are monitored in clinics to carefully determine effectiveness and identify side effects. In their official opposition statement to Measure 109, OPPA says Measure 109 is unsafe and makes misleading promises to Oregonians struggling with mental illness. The OPPA is a district branch of the American Psychiatric Association, which has also said it opposes Measure 109. Here's psychiatrist Dr. Mark Fetman talking a little bit more about the process.
The medicines that psychiatrists use can be very helpful and are frequently very powerful, but they have to be vetted and tested. And in the United States, we have a procedure for doing that. And then medicines are prescribed and used by doctors as treatment. And psychiatrists are the mind doctors. And so this 109 leaves psychiatrists out of the picture. And I think that just does not make any sense. My objection is not that there may be a bad trip, but that in general, the way we do things in a safe manner in the United States is that we have a Food and Drug Administration that approves drugs, and then a Drug Enforcement Administration. Both are federal agencies that oversee the prescribing and use of medications or substances like this. However, in this case, this proposal would do an end run around that and not use the normal procedures in terms of how these things are utilized and offered as treatment to people.
If psychiatrists in Oregon wanted to administer psilocybin, they wouldn't be able to legally. Here's Mark Fetman explaining why.
Even if I wanted to participate in a clinic like the proposed ones that Oregon Health Association would be setting up, I couldn't do it or I'd lose my career because the DEA would take my DEA license away.
Despite all that, Eckert maintains that the psilocybin program could be absolutely safe and effective under the new initiative.
Well, I mean, I would challenge the idea of it being experimental, first of all. Psilocybin has been around forever. It's a natural compound. It's been used by human beings for hundreds, if not thousands of years in ceremonial contexts by Native peoples across the world. And in our Western context, psilocybin-assisted therapy was studied in the 1950s and 60s a lot, and all those studies pointed to it being a real therapeutic agent with an excellent safety track record. And then it was prohibited by Nixon in 1970 for political reasons, not scientific reasons, right? And so in the last 20 years, some really courageous research teams have broken through that red tape to do more research, really robust, rigorous research, again at Johns Hopkins, places like that. And it's just basically confirming what we already know, that psilocybin has an excellent safety record, and when managed in this careful therapeutic context, leads to amazing outcomes. So it's not experimental the way I look at it. It's something that we know a lot about. Psilocybin is not a pharma drug, right? This is not a new drug that's been cooked up in the lab that we don't know anything about. So if it was, it would go through a particular process through the FDA and whatnot. Now, psilocybin is moving through a FDA approval process, and in fact, the FDA has designated it a breakthrough therapy. But at root, psilocybin therapy is a therapeutic experiential modality. It's a therapeutic experience, okay? And I think so the right context for that is a therapeutic context. In other words, creating a safe setting, having a trained facilitator. But they're kind of looking at it through this lens that they want to kind of keep it as a pharma drug, and it can't be patented, and it's a different modality. I know that a lot of medical doctors, in fact, our polling shows that, you know, highly educated folks like medical doctors are generally in favor of this measure.
Measure 109 will be on the ballot this November. A yes vote supports the creation of a program permitting licensed service providers to administer psilocybin to individuals 21 and older. A no vote opposes the creation of this program. Don't forget to keep tuning in to KABU for continuous coverage on the issues and candidates we'll be seeing on the November ballot. And most importantly, don't forget to vote. For KABU, I'm Nat Moon. Thank you.
COO Portland.
Hi, I'm Jenka, KBOO's web and new media coordinator. KBOO's in the last week of our fall membership drive. We're getting close to our $80,000 goal, which we need to reach by October 31st. We need your help to get there.